Yes, it is.
Cool. Okay, welcome, everyone. It's February 23rd, and I'm opening the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and we're going to start with an informational hearing, an overview of emergency housing assistance and the state homeless assistance program. Open it up, and we're going to get kicked off by Ryan Fisher, Community Action Partnership of Oregon, for a state overview.
Thank you, Chair Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fisher. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. And also thank you to Sean Miller, who just let me know that my jacket was tucked into my belt. So you can never thank people enough. So I'm here today representing the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. It's the statewide association of community action agencies. And community action is something that was started 50 years ago by Lyndon Johnson. And you know, community action agencies believe that kids do better in school when everybody has a safe place to call home, that families shouldn't have to choose between paying rent, purchasing food or medicine, and they work with folks who you'll really have very low incomes. You know, you think of your median income in an area and then cut that by a third, and that's about the income that the folks that they're working with that they have. The Community Action Network serves all 36 counties. There's 18 agencies, so every part of Oregon is served by a community action agency. They're largely nonprofit, 501c3s. There are three that are what we call public CAPS, or community action agencies. That would be Multnomah County, Clackamas County, and Lane County. And in those areas, the counties partner with many nonprofits, community-based organizations that do this important work. You know, at the core of what they do, there are a few programs that all of the community action agencies run. Low-income weatherization and energy assistance. So if energy bills are high, that can be a big contributor to this housing instability. And so in addition to helping folks in an emergency situation pay those bills, then there are also services in place to increase the energy efficiency of those homes so that it isn't an ongoing problem. Another core service is emergency rent assistance. So when you're in a situation where, you know, if you're at that income level, any bump in the road can create housing instability. A medical emergency, a flat tire makes it harder to get to work, all of these sorts of things can create an issue when you're paying 50 to 60% of your income for your rent that make it hard to make rent for any particular month. So the emergency housing supports that they provide are extremely important. Some of those come from the federal government, but I'm going to talk today a little bit about the ones that come from the state, because those are critical to the work that they do. Before I get into that, I want to direct your attention to this map that I've provided. It should be on OLIS, and it's a nice color-coded map that shows you the coverage of the community action agencies around the state. One of the things that's unique about community action is they're not cookie-cutter organizations where every one of them does the same thing. They have local boards, and they have a tripartite board structure, meaning that a third are local electeds, a third of their board, a third of the board are folks that have either our current clients or former clients, and then a third are community members. And I focus on that local board and that local control because each year the community action agencies, they do a community needs assessment, and they determine what does our community need in order for folks to be successful. And then they develop programs, or in some cases, peel back programs if there's another organization that's providing that service. One of my favorite examples of this is there are a few community action agencies who run the local bus system in their counties because the county was not able to continue to run the transportation system. people, particularly with low incomes, need buses as transportation. So in Douglas County, the Community Action Agency runs the bus system. At one point in Yamhill County, the Community Action Agency ran the bus system. In Klamath Falls, I visited there this summer, and they run the post office downtown because it was going to close, and those P.O. boxes were important. So there's on the in addition to that map, there's this matrix. And what this matrix does is it lists the community action agencies on one side and then the services they provide. So you can see the diversity of work that they do and how it varies around the state. So the emergency housing account is, and the state homeless assistance program are the two general fund contributions that the state has to the housing stability work that the community action agencies do. And the state homeless assistance program is focused more toward the shelter system that we have, whereas emergency housing account can fund all of the things that the SHAP program can fund, but it has more flexibility and can fund some of these other things that that come up that are necessary to prevent and end homelessness. And you know, I mentioned a flat tire earlier. That's one of the things that that EHA could conceivably fund if that's the detail that is creating housing instability. It can be that first month's deposit. It could be move-in fees, application fees, all of these things that go along with making sure that folks have a place to live. It's incredibly important because there are these federal funds, as I mentioned, that that come in that can be used for emergency rent and some of these other things, but they have a lot of restrictions around them. And the EHA, in particular, is allowed to kind of fill those gaps around what these other resources can do. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how the allocation of EHA and SHAP through the general fund has looked over the last few years, and in particular this past year. So, I said that I would be able to do this here on my own, but I am a Mac user, so. Is that it?
We're sorry.
Oh. I don't have my coat tucked in, do I? So I kind of gave away the exciting conclusion by having that up. But if you look at 2010 and 11 biennium, there were $4 million per year, and that is combining the EHA and the SHAP. If you look at the following biennium, we had $4 million the first year of that biennium, and then we were able to secure some one-time funding. So there was $6 million in the system. And again, this goes out through the community action network that I've been describing. And there's a formula based on some census data, poverty data, et cetera, that's, that has put this formula together. Now, the following year, as you see, we had $10 million in that biennium. We were able to get that added into the base budget, but it was spread out over the biennium. So the first half of that biennium, there was $5 million. So we had a little bit of a decrease from year to year, even though we'd had an increase over the biennium. Now this, in 2016, because of the really the housing crisis that we're facing, and just as a side note, I started in, even before this chart starts, working on housing issues back in 2009. And, you know, I had to ask many times to be able to meet with a lot of legislators about housing. In the last few years, I've had legislators calling me asking to talk about housing because you're all getting phone calls about it from your constituents. So in response to that, there was a one-time allocation on top of that $5 million of $10 million. So right now in the state of Oregon, through this community action network, there is $15 million of EHA and SHAP that is serving folks. And I want to point out that even at this level, when I talk to the Central Oregon Community Action Agency, they're serving about 1 in 25 people that's coming through their doors needing help. You'll hear from some others from other places around the state with similar experiences. However, if you look at the governor's recommended budget or even the co-chair's budget, if it were to be flat funded, we're going to go next year from this $15 million level to $5 million. And so even at this point, and I, you know, obviously we're in a difficult budget crisis, but this is just sort of where we're at right now. We would be going to a third of what we currently have in the system right now. So it's a very difficult time for making sure that these resources are available. And, you know, and on top of that, I think there's a lot of uncertainty about the federal funds that are a big portion of this as well. So that those are the conclusion of my remarks this morning. Unfortunately, you're going to see me a few more times this morning, but I'm very excited about this morning's hearings. There's a few other issues that I'll be speaking with you as well. But the folks that are going to come after are the folks who really are doing this work, and I'm excited for you to hear them. I'm happy to take any questions.
Yeah. I have a question about where the money comes from. Some EHA money is from the document recording fee.
Thank you.
Some
yes.
is from general fund.
So this chart right here is specifically around the general fund allocation. In 2009, the legislature approved a document recording fee, which added $15 to the recording of documents. 10% of that goes to emergency housing account. In 2013, the legislature added an additional $5 to that, which was specifically targeted for veterans. And so another, you know, 10% of that $5 also goes to EHA that is specifically for veterans. And the way that that is structured, now 25% of the document recording fee will be set aside for veterans. So if it were to increase in this biennium, for instance, whatever increase that was, 25% of that would be allocated to veterans as well.
And am I right that right now the document recording fee brings in about $12 million a year, so that would add about $1.2 million for EHA?
That's right. And okay. those numbers come in quarterly, and so, you know, it's ballpark. And I do have some numbers that I got from Housing and Community Services that are more specific. You know, this is round up to the nearest million because that's the math I can do.
Right.
But I'm happy to provide those numbers that we receive from Housing and Community Services. And it breaks out general fund, document recording fee, and then it breaks out the veterans portion of the document recording fee as well.
Okay. Great. Any questions for Ryan?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. So now we're going to hear from different parts of the state. We'll start with Multnomah County and the City of Portland, Mark Jolin. And then we also have Rose Bach here, who actually runs the programs for EHA. Would you like to come up and join him? Be moral support and technical assistance. Rose actually spoke to this committee in, I think it was December,
yes.
and gave a report. And so those of you who may have been here have seen her before. So we're sharing the burden here. Thank you, Mark.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair, Representatives. Thanks for having us here this morning. And my name is Mark Jolin. I'm the director of the Joint Office of Homeless Services. It's a joint office that was formed by Multnomah County and the City of Portland actually July 1st to try to better integrate and streamline the delivery of homeless services in our community. But that work is happening under the auspices of an initiative called A Home for Everyone that is bigger than either the City of Portland or Multnomah County. It includes the City of Gresham, our housing authority, the philanthropic community, the business community. And so I think my job here is to help put EHA and CHAP in the context of our local planning efforts around homelessness and hopefully illustrate how vital those resources are to the outcomes that we're trying to achieve as a community around homelessness and the current housing crisis. So I've got a number of slides that I will walk through. I think. Oh, this is animated. So bear with me. This is the total number of people experiencing HUD homelessness. I'm going to talk a lot about the experience of homelessness when HUD is the source of data. It's only those people who are sleeping outside in a shelter or in transitional housing. They don't tend to count folks who are doubled up. And that is actually the majority of people in our community who are experiencing homelessness. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go forward. The most recent count in the state of Oregon was 13,238 individuals experiencing homelessness on a given night. At least in Multnomah County, we assume that the number of people doubled up is at least three times that many, and it may be higher. For purposes of comparison, Washington had almost 21,000 individuals experiencing homelessness on one night. Portland, Multnomah County, our last comprehensive count was in 2015, so we're in the process right now of updating these numbers, but we had 3,801 HUD homeless individuals, about 13,000 estimated doubled up people in our last count. By way of comparison, Seattle was at almost 11,000. One of the things that I think is important to note here is that in Washington, Seattle is almost half of the homeless population that was counted. In Oregon, as we'll see, and you'll hear from others, Multnomah County has a significant population of people experiencing homelessness, but so does the rest of the state of Oregon. So here are some indications that this isn't just a Multnomah County issue. You see from this most recent HUD report that we had the fifth highest increase in the number of homeless families in 2016 in the country, with the highest percentage unsheltered, about 59%. In the rural parts of Oregon, that number was as high as 75%. We had the highest number of homeless people with children in rural areas of any state, the highest number of unaccompanied youth in rural areas, and the fourth highest percentage unsheltered at 75%. And then as a state, we had the fifth highest percentage of chronically homeless people who are entirely unsheltered at 83%. So overall, Oregon actually has a higher rate of unsheltered homeless people than most states in the country. And again, another indicator that this is a statewide issue and that it impacts every community in the state, the Department of Education issues a statewide report card that documents the number of people, children in public school who are experiencing homelessness. And you can see that while the largest number of kids in school who are homeless is in the metro area, some of the highest rates are in smaller communities around the state. And some of the highest growth rates are seen in smaller communities around the state. We had 21,340 public school students who experienced homelessness last year. It was a record.
Yes. Okay, Mark.
Thank you, yeah. Chair Kinnegar. So when we're looking at these numbers of, you know, record amounts, how is that on, you know, in comparison to population growth? You know, so if we were to take a percentage based off of population, mm-hmm. you know, are we still seeing record growth in those senses, or is it just record amounts because we have more people?
More people. That is a good question that I don't have an answer to. I've not done that comparison. I don't know whether you have an answer for that, Rose, but we can take a look at that. But I haven't seen that analysis done.
So it's not necessarily that we're getting worse at taking care of our homeless. It may just be that our population is in the data. We don't know.
Okay. Right. Well, and I think we're actually doing a better job with the resources we have taking care of people experiencing homelessness, but there are also some things that are driving more people into a position of needing those services, and that's a part of this presentation, is to kind of provide some context for that as well.
Madam Chair? Yes. Yes. Representative.
Maybe I could just a question about the statistics of what they represent. Mm-hmm. A scenario where a friend of my daughter in high school ends up homeless and I take them in,
yes.
and finish the school year, is that reflected in those numbers as being homeless?
It is, probably, in the sense, it depends on how they report it, but in the Department of Education's definition of homelessness, they do include people who are doubled up. So it's anybody who doesn't have a permanent residence of their own. So if they're couch surfing, if they're being taken in by friends, and the significant majority of homeless children in schools are in some form of doubled up arrangement. I think of the 23,000, only somewhere less than 3,000 were unsheltered homeless people.
I'm just trying to decide what the statistics reflect that you're showing. So if they're receiving then state services or maybe services through some emergency housing, mm-hmm. As opposed to getting them from me privately, are they still reflected as homeless then?
Yes. I mean, whether they're receiving state assistance or not really isn't the question. It's sort of what's the circumstance of their housing. So if they're, you know, living on a couch, then they're going to be homeless. The housing status, sort of the nature of their homelessness, does affect what kind of assistance they're eligible for. So HUD funding, for example, rent assistance dollars, can only be used for people who fit the HUD definition of homelessness, so they need to be in a shelter, whereas some of the state funding and the local funding can use a broader definition of homelessness to provide assistance.
So then my next question would be, at what point are they no longer counted as homeless?
as soon as they have a lawful permanent residence of their own. So if they've now moved into an apartment, they're in a shared housing arrangement that's a permanent situation that they've entered into voluntarily, that's how they want to live. So if your child chooses to live with you because it is, then they're not going to be considered homelessness. If they have to live with you, it's not their choice, but for financial reasons they have no alternative, their child might be counted as homeless in that situation. Again, it's a report that is initiated by the child or the parent.
Thank you. That helps me understand what the statistics are reflecting.
Yeah.
And just to go back to the first one, you had that first set. I think you said that did not include, when it said 3,000 people homeless, it did not include people who were doubled up, or
right.
It does?
It does not.
It does not. So those were smaller numbers because it's really the unsheltered.
Exactly. So the total number of individuals in families in the state on one night under the HUD definition is somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000, I think.
That's unsheltered. That's a stricter definition.
So, the number of homeless families, if you use the Department of Education's broader definition, is substantially higher than that.
Okay. Representative Peluso.
Thank you, Chair. It would just seem to me that this is not an accurate science.
Absolutely.
And I think that's part of the challenge, and as we try to harness the numbers, mm-hmm. it has to be just completely in flux all the time.
So
I appreciate that we're taking our best shot, but yeah, there are a lot of factors that impact that.
About the person that moved into your home.
So we're working with sort of orders of magnitude, is sort of how I think about it. No counting methodology is perfect, whether it's trying to count all the people who are outside on the street. The closest we get is with shelter.
Yeah.
There we can get a pretty accurate read, but even trying to count how many people are in motel rooms, certainly how many people are involuntarily doubled up, those are all very imperfect methods. So we're really trying to get a sense of the scale. And we know we're in the ballpark, but we don't have the specific.
And I think that's important to note, so we're not taking it as the gospel at this stage of the game. It's always a moving target.
And if anything, it's undercounted, probably.
Oh, definitely. I would agree. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So locally in Multnomah County, within A Home for Everyone, the process has started with the creation of a plan. So often I'm asked, what's the plan? Well, we've got a plan. So that's the starting point. It's a shared vision. It's a set of shared values. It's some very specific areas of action that needs to be taken. So in the area of housing, obviously, income and benefits, so employment-related activities, health care, making sure that folks are getting the health care services they need. That could be recovery, mental health, physical health care, survival and emergency services. What are we going to do with folks who are outside tonight who don't even have the basic access to shelter they need? Then generally, how are we getting equitable access to services? So if we got our system working well so that people can get to the services that they need. And then finally, are we coordinating these systems? Because there are a lot of people involved in delivering homeless services in Multnomah County, and counties around the state, but probably particularly Multnomah County. Those organizations need to be working well together in order to get the best outcomes from the resources that we've got. So we've got a plan, and then really importantly, you got to bring the community together around that plan. And the solutions to homelessness aren't just government solutions. They've got to bring the private sector in, the faith community in, the nonprofits, importantly, the people who've got lived experience of homelessness. And so locally, this is what we've created. Other communities have their versions of it, but it's an executive committee that has the mayor and our county chair and the city of Gresham elected officials, the head of our housing authority, our business alliance, coming together every 2 months to set the goals for the community, hold us accountable for the work that we're doing and how the dollars are getting invested. And then underneath that, all the people whose lives are touched by this work or whose work touches the lives of people experiencing homelessness, they're there at the table to contribute to the conversation. If our goal is to end veterans homelessness, for example, what's it going to take to make that happen? What are the strategies that we know work? What are the resources we're going to need? Where do we find those resources in the community? So how do we think about the process of ending homelessness? At one level, the discussion is complicated. There are a lot of factors involved. But at another level, this is a very simple formula. The number of people who are outside on our streets or in our shelters on any given night is a function of the rate of inflow into homelessness versus the rate of outflow out of homelessness. the people who are on our streets tonight and in our shelters tonight are not the same people who are going to be there tomorrow. Because some of those people who are there tonight are going to move out of homelessness, either because we helped them do it or because they resolved it on their own. And people who are in housing today are going to find themselves homeless tonight because they weren't able to pay the rent, they had some kind of a health crisis, whatever the driver was for them, they weren't homeless yesterday, they are homeless tonight. So when we're looking at trying to reduce the number of people or experiencing homelessness, what we're either going to do is reduce the number of people coming into homelessness, right? We're going to reduce the inflow, or we're going to increase the outflow out of homelessness, or we're going to do both.
Oh, wait, question?
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. So that prompted another question about your statistics.
Yeah.
Do we, or in any of this stuff, are you making a distinction between what in Josephine County we've begun making a distinction between homeless and professional vagrant?
Hmm.
And where there are people that have truly intended, I mean, Dignity Village is an example, people who have said, I don't fit that mold of society, I have no interest in your shelters or any, and they choose to live that sort of lifestyle as opposed to the, you know, the single mom that couldn't pay rent that month. Do we make any sort of distinction? Because that population seems that it wouldn't fit this formula.
So within the unmet need, there's a group that has been on the streets longer that's often thought of as the chronically homeless population. I would say what we need there is a different set of strategies. They are part of the population. We know from working with some of those folks who initially indicate that they've sort of chosen this life or that they're not interested in services, that often what's really going on there is that we're not offering them the right kind of service. They've many of those folks, when they first became homeless, tried to get off the street, went through the shelter system, went through the they didn't work for them for whatever reason. They gave up. They lost hope that their life was ever going to be anything better than it is right now, and they've kind of accommodated themselves to that life. And so, you know, our challenge is to figure out how to restore a little bit of that hope, because we know that, you know, even if right at the moment they're content where they are, the impact of having folks living outside on their own health, but on our public safety resources, our health resources, is going to be a significant cost to the community. And so we've had good success through a variety of kind of housing first strategies and outreach strategies, engaging those very folks who go to stay at Dignity Village in a process of moving out of there and getting back into permanent housing. It's a different approach than we have to take with the mom who just lost her housing and has a kid and is, you know, every day just want nothing more than to get back into another place. But we don't have too many people for whom it's a situation where if we bring the right kind of service and the right kind of housing opportunity, they're going to turn it down because they're okay with where they're at outside.
Okay. Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To go back to what Representative Stark was saying, though, how many people do you think would be the type to say, I don't feel safe in a shelter, and mm-hmm. therefore I don't want to use that? Does that tie in with that population?
So for me, that is a little bit of a different question. So whereas I think there are very few people outside who, if offered a decent permanent place to live of their own, wouldn't take it. There are a significant number of people for whom a large congregate shelter environment is not workable for a variety of reasons. Some of those we can address. So as we've gone to expand shelter in Multnomah County significantly, almost doubled the number of beds in the last year, we haven't just doubled beds, but we've tried to address the barriers that often keep people from coming inside. So we've created a couple shelter. We've got a shelter that allows people to bring their pets in. We don't require them to participate in program. We offer them programming once they're inside. So we can do some things mm-hmm. to mitigate, and there are some folks for whom living with 130 other people or 50 other people is going to be triggering for their mental health. And so they're going to choose to stay outside instead of coming into shelter. But again, it doesn't necessarily mean that they want to be homeless. It means that we need to offer them a different path off the street
right.
than a shelter, a traditional shelter.
Follow up. So I want to go back. I think the one thing that's really innovative that we're finally starting to see is the issue of pets.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've encountered a lot of folks that are homeless, and they have a dog. And traditionally, we didn't want the dogs. And in many cases, that might be their only companion. Mm-hmm. And so that move to take care of that particular need, I think, is really, really important, and hopefully we'll expand that.
And it's been, I think, even for our shelter providers who are not used to having pets in their shelters, these low-barrier shelters have worked better than they imagined they would. And they've figured out how to accommodate multiple, not just dogs, but different types of animals. Mm-hmm. Folks are able to coexist. They're able to segment a little bit. And really, as long as the participants in the program are maintaining control of their animals and the animals aren't dangerous to people, it's working just fine.
Excellent.
So it's been game-changing for a lot of folks.
Thanks.
So this is the basic model. This is just an example of sort of how to chart the hydraulics of this model. So if you take that dashed line there and say that was the total number of people we were placing into housing in any given year, somewhere around 3,000, and we know that the rate of homelessness on our streets isn't changing. So in Multnomah County, when we did a count in 2013, we had, and then did it again in 2015, we had almost no change in the total number of people experiencing homelessness. But we knew we had housed about 6,000 people in that two-year period, right? So that told us, in essence, that, you know, at 3,000 people a year, there are at least that many people coming in, and so we're not making any progress sort of drawing down the number of people experiencing homelessness on any given night. So what we know is, you know, and this is a version of it, is if we, through the red line, push up the number of people we're placing into housing, again, increasing the outflow, and at the same time start to do better job of prevention, that's your blue line, that green line, the solid one, is going to start to come down. Now, exactly how far it comes down depends on some things that are beyond our control in terms of inflow, right? What's going on in the housing market, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But it is, at this level, can be that simple, right? It is figuring out, what are we doing on prevention? What are we doing on placement? Mm-hmm. How is that going to change? And you'll see that both EHA and SHAP are central to that conversation. The other thing that this allows us to understand pretty straightforwardly is the number of unsheltered people we see on our streets, right? So as long as the unmet need for housing is higher than the number of shelter beds we have in our community, we're going to have people living on the sidewalks.
Right.
And we can take a couple of different approaches to addressing all those people who are sleeping outside. One is we can increase shelter capacity, which is something we do. And we can also do a better job on prevention and a better job on placement, because both of those things, as you can see with the red line and the gray dotted line, make that triangle smaller, right? They reduce the distance between our current capacity and the number of people who need shelter. So locally, this comes down to a balanced approach. Our priority is on prevention. It's the least destabilizing for the families. It's almost always the most cost-effective intervention we can make. And it's very hard to do prevention upstream anywhere near the level we would like to. If we can't prevent a family from becoming homeless, we want to divert them straight out of the housing situation they're in into some other housing. So if they're going to lose their place, we want to find them a new affordable place if we can. We don't want them coming to the street. We don't want them coming to the shelter if that doesn't have to happen. If they do find themselves outside, the next thing we want to do is get them back into permanent housing right away, right? Our wait times in shelter are months long. We're not going to ask a family to wait outside for months to get into shelter. Well, not families in Multnomah County. We have a no turnaway shelter for families. But we're not going to ask someone to wait outside to get into shelter before we start working with them on getting back into permanent housing. If there's a permanent housing option tomorrow, we're going to take it. That's essentially what we mean by housing first, and we're going to use rent assistance resources like EHA to move those folks into housing as quickly as possible. Only where permanent housing is not available do we want folks going into shelter. We often think of shelter as being the sort of ready solution to homelessness, but actually it doesn't end anybody's homelessness. It's also often not less expensive. At least in Multnomah County, we're spending about $10,000 per bed per year on average, and it varies by size of shelter and population served. For that kind of money, I can often move somebody directly into permanent housing and give them the rent assistance they need to be successful there. Doesn't mean we don't need shelter. We just need to make sure we're using it appropriately in this kind of balanced way. So in this planning work we're doing within A Home for Everyone, with the modeling we're doing, with the sort of focus on inflow, outflow, and then shelter where necessary, we've set some very specific targets around expanding capacity this year. We think in terms of the fiscal years locally, So we're pushing ourselves right now to move from a system that has been doing about 5,000 preventions a year to one that's doing 6,000, a system that was doing 3,000 placements a year to one that's doing 4,350 placements, and then expanding our shelter capacity by 650 beds. Do I know that those are exactly the right numbers? No, but at least we've got some very specific targets that we're going after as a community. And then we've got to monitor our progress, right? So we've got a plan. We get people around the table together to align the resources and the work. We understand the dynamics of the issue. We set specific targets, and then we monitor the outcomes that we're getting from those targets. So here, I'll put in the EHA and CHAP piece, because EHA and CHAP are centrally important to every one of the strategies that you see up there. Those outcomes that we are getting right now, we would not be getting without the current level of EHA and CHAP funding in the system. So, Rose, do you want to talk a little bit about the prevention side of the resource? Not to put you on the spot, but
So EHA is one of
for the record. Could you
Rose Back, the co-director of Youth and Family Services at Multnomah County. EHA is one of our primary prevention strategies. As Mark mentioned before, we often marry EHA funds with other funds that are a little more difficult or take a little longer time for people to access. We use them for a multitude of purposes to keep people housed, to keep them get them in housed. One of our most recent, I've been using as one of our EHA success stories is. Some of you may have heard about a school in the Cully neighborhood. There's a building close to the Rigler Elementary School where 35 families had received a notice that their rent was going to increase 100%. So the kids were going to have to move out of school in March. So we were able to use EHA to keep them and pay help them pay the rent increase through the end of June so the kids could at least finish the school year. And that's the kind of flexibility that we're able to use EHA for. It gives us some time to help get them into other programs and help look for other housing options without destabilizing the children, which is always our first priority. And then also, we've been increasingly using EHA for our senior citizens and people with disabilities who are also suffering with rent increases. And even if we use it for, 3 or 6 months, will we find a longer-term option that's more affordable for them? It keeps them from having to go into the shelter.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. A question for you, and this for everybody out there who I know over the next several months would be testifying a lot. Can you tell me on the increase, well done, by the way, keeping them in their homes and being able to assist. Anytime I hear a statement of the increase of rents, I'm always curious what rent they were paying and what the dollar amount and what it was raised to.
At that particular building, most of the rents were $650, and they went up to $1,300. And it was literally 5% of the elementary school's population that was impacted by that. So it also was going to have a destabilizing impact on the entire school as well as the community.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
So we also, in particular, are using SHAP on the shelter side. So I talked about some of the shelter expansion work. We did commit to adding 650 beds of year-round shelter to the system and to serving women in particular, both. So we have a specific women's shelter that is being funded with the SHAP resources. We have a family shelter that is a no turnaway shelter, meaning that as many folks as come are going to find shelter there. It was designed to hold 130 individuals on any given night. They are routinely in overflow over 200 people on any given night. SHAP resources are helping sustain that capacity in the family shelter. SHAP resources are also centrally important to our domestic violence shelter system. So we have 3 secure site shelters that are receiving SHAP funding. We also use those resources for motel vouchers, which are really critical in the for families escaping domestic violence, for women escaping domestic violence, as a particular additional safety resource. So the role of SHAP in this capacity that we have created, and I can tell you that as we've created it, every single shelter bed has filled, and there are still probably 2,000 people, we'll know for sure, sleeping outside. So this expanded capacity has been important, and in and of itself, it is still not enough. But CHAP is very centrally important to that work.
Yeah, Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To go back to the question of domestic violence shelters, which we know we don't have enough of, do you coordinate with groups that already provide shelter specifically for domestic violence, like think of Bradley Angle as an example, so that if they can't find something there, they're directed to one of maybe your facilities?
Yeah, so our office is really just the kind of coordinating entity. Mm-hmm. So we, for the city and the county, we allocate the funding for shelters, so they would be our contracted partners.
Okay.
So and the domestic violence system through Rose's program is coordinated not just at the government level but at the provider level to make sure that there's access across those different agencies for people who are needing specific kinds of resources.
Yes, so we coordinate through Multnomah County Department of Human Services. We coordinate not only with the Joint Office on the homeless shelter beds for victims of domestic violence, but also around our prevention efforts, our diversion efforts, our safety planning, and our work with local law enforcement for safety.
Great. So, Mark, probably
Thank
one
you.
More minute.
Just one. Okay.
Move on to other
well,
parts of the state.
I'll go. So, oh. yeah. So all of this work, and this is really challenged by what's going on in the rental market. So the outcomes that we're achieving are great. It's critical. We've got thousands of people who are not homeless today because of the investments that we've been able to make on the prevention and placement side. And not just in Portland and Multnomah County, but around the state, there's this growing divide between incomes, especially for very low-income people, and what it costs to rent housing. And so what you've got here is examples from various recent reports and studies showing this dynamic at the national level and at the state level. I won't read them to you, but the dynamic is very much present everywhere. And so these are a couple of quick illustrations of that. So here in the orange line, what you see is the amount of rent that a low-wage earning household, a household making 30% of area median income, think full-time minimum wage work, can afford, which is in the neighborhood of about $500 a month. And for a one-bedroom apartment, now the rents in Portland area are at $1,000 a month. A three-person household making 30% is making about $20,000 a year. They need a two-bedroom apartment. They can afford $500. Two-bedroom apartments are costing $1,200. So when you are having to close that gap with very limited income, you are always in jeopardy, and Ryan referenced this, always in jeopardy of losing your housing and finding yourself homeless if you can't find another place to rent quickly, which is incredibly difficult. It's even more dramatic when you get down into folks with very limited fixed incomes. So what you see here is a chart that shows the growing difference between a long-term disability benefit, which is at about $733 a month. In Multnomah County, we have 18,000 people whose only income is an SSI benefit of $733, and what it costs to rent an apartment, a one-bedroom apartment. At some point, it used to be in our community that you could it would cost you a lot of your income, but you could find a studio apartment that you could afford or at least pay for with a long-term disability check. In 2010, that stopped being true, and the situation has gotten worse and worse. And so we have a growing number of people who cannot find housing in our market unless there is a subsidy attached to it, and we don't have nearly enough of those subsidies available. So the summary, I guess, of this is that we know what works. We've got plans. We've got the right people at the table. What we don't have is the ability to scale these strategies to the level that we need to scale them, especially given what's going on in the housing market. And when I say we know what works, I'll just say quickly, we know it in part because of what we just went through with our effort to end veterans homelessness in Multnomah County. We came together, we leveraged the federal dollars, the state dollars, the local dollars, the private market, the philanthropic community around a shared plan. We committed ourselves to it, and over 2 years, we were able to build a system that can provide a permanent housing option to every veteran who we identify in our community as having become homeless. In 2 years, we helped over 1,300 veterans move off the street back into permanent housing. We were actually certified by the federal government as having functionally ended veterans' homelessness. Doesn't mean we don't have homeless veterans, but we've actually built a system
first
with
in
these
the country,
tools,
right? Right?
First in the country, first West Coast city in the country. But we've built a system with the tools scaled to the necessary level to be able to end homelessness for that population. We can do it for others as well. We just don't have the resources in place to make it happen. So thank you all very much.
Thank you very much. That's great. Thank you so much. Okay, great. So next, let's bring up Jeff Sargent and Peggy McGuire together. And you each have 10 minutes.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chairs, members of the committee. Peggy McGuire, Director of Housing and Energy Services at Community Services Consortium. We are the community action agency that serves Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. And I just thought that I would talk with you a little bit today about how we use EHA and CHAP funds in our community. You know, I got to thinking that if I came to each of your homes and looked in your cupboards and your closets, I would probably find the same things from a little list. I would have, you know, salt and pepper, sugar, toilet paper, probably some duct tape in there. And those are the things that we need to operate our household. And those, that exact analogy is how I is what I apply to EHA and CHAP funds. Our community action agencies cannot operate our housing programs without EHA and CHAP funds. They're just essential. Most of the federal dollars that we receive, as Ryan mentioned, have very strict requirements, very limited admin, if any, and have match requirements. So in order to even be able to obtain the federal funds, we have to have matching dollars to be able to support that. And those are, using the EHA and CHAP funds, we match those federal dollars, and we support the administration of the programs for those federal programs with EHA and CHAP dollars. You know, our client situations are as varied as the clients out there, as Mark was talking about, all the different types of homeless situations people are in and the reasons that they're homeless. So when somebody comes to our agency to see a case manager, first of all, they're screened to make sure that they're eligible for the type for the funds and what types of eligibility for which types of funds. But it's kind of a seamless process for the client. The client just gives information, and our housing case managers are kind of like the chefs in the kitchen. They're putting together all the patchwork of funds that can help that particular client with their own specific set of circumstances. So here's an example. We had a family that were living in a travel trailer on somebody's property. The homeowner sold the property. The folks in the travel trailer had to leave. Dad was in an entry-level service industry job, and Mom was on unemployment. And when they came to us, we looked at which programs they qualified for, and they made $20 a month too much to qualify for most of the federal programs we had. So the only way that we could help them was with EHA funding. And we were able to get them in some other housing. Rose talked about homeless prevention. The only funds that we have available for preventing people from becoming homeless, which, as has already been mentioned, is the least expensive way to help somebody, the only funds we have are EHA funds to do that. Our shelters desperately need the CHAP funds in our communities. Those funds buy bedding, they buy toiletries. We use the funds to purchase food at an extremely discounted rate from the food bank to help feed the folks who are in the shelters. What else can I tell you about this? There are huge, huge data requirements. So you saw the numbers that were that everybody's been displaying. We have to track those numbers. We have to do the annual point in time count. And we're required for anybody that we assist with any of our homeless dollars to put them into a homeless management information system. So gather some specific data about the clients. And that is hopefully going to eventually be able to get us to the point where we do know exactly what the numbers are. There won't be a lot of confusion about how many people are truly homeless. But all of that takes money. Case management takes money. And most of those federal funds, as I mentioned, don't come with any kind of support for that data collection or for the case management. We want our clients to be successful. If we put them into a housing program, we want them to become stabilized and be able to support themselves and so that they're not coming back consistently for services. The only way to do that is to provide some additional case management and offer them the opportunity to access services. So EHA funds help pay for those services. Deposits, paying security deposits. Most of the programs that we have from the feds do not allow us to pay security deposits or move-in fees or screening charges, all of which are required for people to get into housing. And additionally, most of those federal programs have a strict limit as to what can be paid for rent. So they give us a fair market value of what they think the rent should be, and that fair market value always lags significantly behind what the real market is doing. So when clients come in, if they're able to find housing and it is over that fair market value, the only way we can help is by matching some EHA resources to the rent assistance that the federal programs would allow to enable those clients to be housed. Vice Chair Stark asked about people coming into the community versus people in the community. And what we've found anecdotally by talking with our homeless clients is the vast majority of them are people who've lived long-term in our communities, and their circumstances have simply changed. They've lost a spouse or a roommate. They've lost their job. The particular housing situation that they had is now unavailable to them. You know, landlords changing over to vacation day rentals, or they increase the rent so high that there's no way that the individual can stay in the housing. And they just become homeless, but they remain in the community. So that's what we're finding in our areas. I think that covers most of the things I wanted to share with you about how we use the funds, and I think that it's similar in most of our sister community action agency shops that they use the funds in those ways too. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Yes.
Thanks, Chair Kenny. Actually, more of a comment, just clarification. When in Josephine County, I do acknowledge that it's unique in that with the lack of law enforcement and jail beds, that we have been a beacon there for professional vagrants who have come in order to, you know, not people who have been long-term residents, but have come in to take advantage of the situation. So that's why that community has begun to try to make a distinction there. So just to clarify.
Okay.
Oh, I have one.
Yes, Representative Forsyth.
Are you from the Yamhill County area? Is that right? Or
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Gorsuch, I am not. I'm Lynn Benton in Lincoln County.
Lynn
I think
Benton
I substituted for the Yamhill
okay.
person.
No,
right.
This is the Yamhill.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Right here.
Sorry.
There we go. So Lynn Benton in Lincoln. Yeah. Got it.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny-Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, and members of the committee. It's nice to see a couple of representatives from Yamhill County, with Representative Noble and Representative Nierman here as well. Thank you for the opportunity and the honor to address you this morning to share how EHA and SHAP dollars have been a vital and recently even more dramatic part of our efforts to improve the lives of residents in Yamhill County. I'll begin with a story and then share with you how our current EHA and SHAP dollars have impacted us thus far, how the new EHA and SHAP allocation from 2017 is improving what we do, and then how we've leveraged those funds and what we can do more. So first with a success story. Recently, a family of five came to us seeking rental assistance. The father had been injured on the job and was unable to work for over a month while he was in rehab. So the family was trying to live on TANF dollars, temporary assistance for needy families. We all know that's difficult. They were getting behind on their bills, and they finally got that dreaded eviction notice. So they came to us. We were able to step in with EHA dollars, provide 2 months of rental assistance so the father could complete his rehabilitation and get back to work. 3 months later, the family is still in stable housing, and we're working with them on a budget to help them save up to be able to have a stronger future. So for the 2015 and 17 biennium, we were allocated for the entire biennium, with EHA, just about $179,000, and for SHAP, $80,000, for which we are extremely grateful. With EHA, that offers us the ability to provide homeless prevention, rapid rehousing, emergency and temporary shelter, and case management. These funds, along with other grants that we receive, enabled us to provide 157 households with either short-term or long-term rental assistance. And as you heard before, the flexibility of EHA dollars allows us to combine them with other grants to extend them even further. The SHAP grants fund our shelter operations and case management for shelter clients. We own and operate three shelters in Yamhill County, two in McMinnville and one in Newburgh. Together, they can house up to 35 families or single women at one time. Many are fleeing domestic violence, as you've heard, and of course, many are children. Typically, a total of about 130 persons will live in our shelters over the course of the year for about anywhere from 1 to 6 months. With the remarkable and much-needed increase that was provided in EHA and SHAP dollars last year, we were allocated an additional $173,000 from EHA and about $48,000 for SHAP. And combined with our base amount, that equated to a total of 35% of our current client services and housing budget. So when we heard that these new 2017 dollars were approved, our adult and youth programs director, Kate Stokes, she immediately sprung into action. She came to me to discuss a vision she had for a whole new homeless prevention and shelter diversion program. We had been doing some of those activities before, but not in a concentrated new program type of way. And that included us hiring two new staff members, a full-time case manager specifically for that program, and a housing specialist. So this new program enabled us to quickly begin outreach and to provide rapid funding for individuals who were facing eviction or the loss, impending loss of their homes due to, as you've heard, some type of crises, medical or otherwise. It also allowed us to initiate new and more concerted efforts to reach out to landlords. Today, our housing specialist, Mary Leathers, has built positive relationships since September with 46 kind-hearted local landlords. And in our most recent landlord lunch that we hosted, where we introduce our program, we were able to welcome 12 new landlords. And these landlords are generous enough to often give us first option when they have an opening before they advertise a unit on the market. The program also enables us to provide deposit and rental guarantees and case management for these clients, many of them who have very difficult past rental histories, and therefore we're providing that security to the landlord. And it helps us get individuals who have lost their homes through our shelters and back into stable housing much more rapidly. So we're turning people through our shelters now rather than an average of 3 to 6 months in more like 1 to 2 months, which obviously enables us to help more people. And our program manager, Shauna Williams, she's able to now provide comprehensive guidance for these families once they get into stable housing to help them maintain that stability and plan better for the future, because we know that that case management, that guidance is essential for future success. The additional SHAP funds have enabled us to perform significant and much needed maintenance on our two McMinnville shelters. Last year, we ripped out all this old nasty carpet that had been there for a while in both and installed new donated laminate flooring, as well as replaced all the old beds. Just last month, we put in new energy efficient windows, and soon we're going to start painting both of the shelters, which haven't had a new coat in about 25 years. So as you can imagine, these type of upgrades aid not only the physical but mental health of our clients because they're going through trauma, and they improve the livability of the entire neighborhood. So how have we leveraged these funds? Well, last summer, we also approached Meyer Memorial Trust to apply for a $100,000 two-year housing opportunities grant, which was intended to allow us to extend this new homeless prevention and shelter diversion concept even further. Well, we found out in November that we got that grant. And the two primary reasons we did was, one, our proven track record in success with homelessness and housing services, and two, because we had launched the new homeless prevention and shelter diversion program, which was a result of these 2017 EHA dollars. So we couldn't have earned that grant and leveraged those resources without your generous investment. So how can we do even more? Our new prevention program is taking off. Since September of 2016, we've received 430 inquiries about it on our homeless prevention hotline. In 5 months, we've been able to help 45 families with short and long-term rental assistance just through EHA and SHAP alone, as we continue to build those landlord relationships and provide rapid funding when people get eviction notices and provide that extensive case management. But of course, that 45 is, as you've heard from others, a small fraction of the demand out there. So we know we have the proven management expertise, and we have the skills in our staff to do more, but like everybody else who comes before you, we just need more resources. If we lose the increased funding that was provided from this current year, then we will at least lose one of those new staff positions and obviously be able to serve significantly fewer clients. Now, we all know how dire the affordable housing situation is here in Oregon, of course, and it's no different in Yamhill County. So as you've also heard from others, that prevention aspect, keeping people in their homes or getting them back into stable shelter as quickly as possible, is the best way to keep them off the streets, falling into further crisis, and adding additional burden and cost to our health, our social services, and public safety services. I'll close with this. Last year, towards the end of the year, a young pregnant woman and her partner came to us. They were living in an outdoor garden shed and had lost their shelter because of trauma in both families. A relative of the young girl had found them some housing and a job working maintenance for the landlord, but they didn't have the funds to be able to pay the deposit. So naturally, they came to us with EHA funds again. We were able to pay that deposit, and the couple moved into stable apartment in January. So now they have a safe place to be able to give birth to their new child, and they're both working and planning for a better future. So that's just one of thousands of heartwarming stories that you hear here in Oregon that you have helped and can continue to make possible. You help us make that bridge to give people a hand up so they can face those floodwaters and get back on stable ground. So I appreciate your time and your support, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff, any questions? Yes. Our Yamhill representative.
More just a comment, a shout-out to all the work that Jeff and YCAP does. I also am familiar with Community Service Consortium and appreciate their work, but I've had a chance specifically to tour and even work in their food bank sorting food. One thing he didn't say is it's not just leveraging, but the partnerships in the community. There's also other families I'm aware of where service clubs, faith community, YCAP, and others have come alongside to actually refurbish a home that was poisoned to the children, and very good work.
Social service agencies work so well together. Yes,
I think you need to get your paintbrush out for your next visit.
absolutely.
Yeah, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to hear a little more. Maybe you can do this offline and get it to my office about the program you're working with partnering with landlords. And some of the incentive programs or whatever, you know, type of how you're building those relationships, because I think that would be a fantastic product to, you know, share to other counties and communities.
Absolutely. I'll be happy to get more details for you and forward it to the whole committee through the the system here. Is that appropriate?
Well, that would be great. And it's also a great segue into the next three bills that we're going to hear, which are attempts at having partnerships with landlords to really have them be part of the solution of creating more housing. So with that, I will close the informational hearing on the overview of EHA and SHAP. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
We've got three bills this morning. We're going to have them introduced by the people who brought them to us and then have some comments from the Oregon Housing and Community Services for any kind of technical, not for advocacy one way or another, just technical answers about what's happening now with those programs. So, Representative Parrish, we're going to open the public hearing on your House Bill 2944. I do see that the speaker is on 2446. I see the speaker is here and has a bill, but she has said she's interested in all three bills. So we're holding her off until after you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland and Tualatin. And this bill came out of one of our, when I was served on the committee previously, in our last term, came out of some testimony where we had heard that Section 8 vouchers.
Could you hold 1 second?
Sure.
Could I have her read
the summary? Yes, do the summary, please. Right. There we
and
go.
I also forgot to say that we are not doing any of the work sessions. None of the bills that are on for a possible work session are ready with amendments. So we will be posting those for the next time, which hopes they'll be ready. So go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2446 requires Housing and Community Services and Oregon Housing Stability Council to seek, obtain, and renew existing waivers for specific federal rent subsidy and assistance payments. The bill specifies continued eligibility for federal rent subsidies and assistance payments for certain circumstances when individuals or families are otherwise eligible.
Okay, so there you go. For the record, again, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin, bringing you House Bill 2446. In a previous term on this same committee, we had heard testimony that Section 8, that you could not co-house in Section 8. And then I've heard since we've drafted this bill as a result of that committee that maybe you can and maybe you can't. And I've heard from agencies, but then I also heard from a county commissioner who is part of their fair housing folks here in Marion County who said, no, I'm pretty sure we've been told you can't do co-housing. So there's a little bit of questioning about that that we're going to continue to kind of more deeply explore. But even if for a moment that you can, the other piece of this, which is not in this, and I will bring an amendment for, is that there is some concern about how a co-housing Section 8 voucher would be paid, which would be much less than maybe what fair market rents are, even in a shared housing situation. So I think we want to address that issue as well. And so really what this comes from is, you know, in my own county, Clackamas County, we have people who get Section 8 vouchers. They can't find a place to use them because the voucher doesn't match what the, you know, what the rents will bear for a single market, a single family type unit home. So when I think of my own family who was on Section 8 as a child growing up, a mom with six kids, you don't really easily stuff into an apartment. And so you really need to have single unit housing available for families who are on Section 8. And so this bill also seeks to attempt to look at a population of folks who are potential landlords who don't know that they could be potential landlords. If we do allow under the current Section 8 laws a co-housing, most folks probably don't know that that's available to them as an option. And so we would like to get the waivers to make sure that, one, we can, and that, two, that the market rate rents are able to be used, that voucher, let's say it's $800 for a family of, you know, two, I don't know exactly what the number is, that can be used in a maximum way to help somebody who's a landlord. So in this particular waiver, what we're asking for is that the landlord is not somebody who's family, that in a co-housing type model, that the Section 8 tenant would have kind of the run of the house. They would be able to use the kitchen facilities and laundry facilities. I think it's important that if you're going to be part of a co-housing type model, that you have access to the shared spaces in the house, that you would also have bedrooms that, you know, bathroom facility that locks and has separate ability to be separate from a landlord, I think is important as well. But we do want to make sure that as rent is calculated in a co-housing model, that it's not just, you know, the you're getting a room and that room's maybe a couple hundred dollars when a voucher for that mom might have been worth much more. The other thing that's interesting to me outside of this is if we can get some waivers, I think there's a different way to think about how we match those folks or seek out and advertise to people who could be landlords, and actually partnering with our county assessors. So if you have a mom who's a single mom and she's got two kids and she lives in Estacada, then you could use your county property tax rolls to identify houses and people who own homes who of a certain size. We know the square footage in those property tax rolls. You know that how many rooms are in that house. You can look at the stability of the homeowner, somebody who's been there for, you know, 10, 15 years. And look at the age of the homeowner. Is this person an empty nester? And you could then select a pool of people and then send them out an opportunity that says, hey, we have, you know, we've matched you to somebody who might want to come in and actually look at being a landlord. And you didn't weren't thinking about that until you get a letter from your county. Now you can actually drill down and try to find landlords partnering with the county in Section 8 based on what we think might be a good fit, and educate folks who might be empty nesters. This is a good opportunity for them to open up their home and have a secondary source of income so that they can stay in their house. But the data's all there. It's almost like a match.com for Section 8 tenants. And it's really agnostic of all of some of the other, you know, things that go into housing, right? Sometimes the concerns about, well, who are you renting to, or who's the, you know, the landlord wants to, you know, pick and choose. This is saying, hey, we have somebody and we've matched you as somebody who might be able to, you know, meet this obligation as our opportunity as a landlord. And I think we could pilot that. I think we would look at something like that in our counties and use that opportunity. But I think we first have to address, can we do it? And are you going to be able to use that Section 8 voucher at a market rate rent? And so so that's the waiver we're asking for.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Representative Parrish. Yes.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. So I'm reading the bill, and I got your description of what is co-housing or communal living or whatever. So what do you think is typical on that? Is that my house, and I have an extra bedroom, and I have a bathroom that I use, but it's lockable, so I could rent it to the Section 8 person, and then they can use my kitchen. That would that count as communal living under this bill?
Or? Under this bill, you would need to, as a landlord, be able to, and a co-housing landlord, you would need to be able to provide them a separate bedroom space, separate bathroom space. So that would be the sort of separate facilities, but the rest of the housing would be run of house. So kitchen, laundry, shared communal living space.
And then we just fight over who gets the remote then. Right?
That's right. That might be an okay fight to have if somebody actually has a place to watch TV.
I appreciate this work. I sometimes I think on the housing thing, I think, what did we do back in 1910 or something like that? Mm-hmm. And I think we kind of, we lived with mom or something like that, and we had kind of more kind of family structures or whatever. So I think this is kind of a, at least kind of a shadow of that, or kind of an imitation of that. So mm-hmm. I kind of like that.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Nierman, you know, the challenge is we can look at all kinds of ways to solve housing. It doesn't solve the supply side issue. We know in the metro area we need at least 80,000 units. We also know that when you have a section, especially particularly in Section 8, and I would just go back to growing up myself, hard to find landlords who want to take on, you know, mom with a bunch of kids. And also then keep those kids connected to their schools, connected to their pediatrician, connected to, you know, clubs and sports and whatever things that you're trying to give that family a sense of normalcy. So the idea that we can maybe pair folks, and there's some, actually there was a woman who came to my office, said, I love this bill, and I'm, you know, I'm actually got a shared website, you know, shared housing website. We're trying to match people and find sort of that common ground on shared housing. But of course, you know, the Section 8 piece is not necessarily in that model. We'd like to have that, I think, in her model. But the ability to keep kids in their community, I love the idea of being able to go in and find, you know, if you have a mom with two kids and you find a house on the county property tax rolls that is in Estacada, and the mom's in Estacada and she wants to stay in Estacada, and you can actually drill down and say, well, there's 10 houses that meet that criteria, because mom can have a bedroom plus a bedroom for her kids. It's a 4-bedroom house. It's a 3,000 square foot house. Send that family, you know, send that household a letter and say, you know, you're part of a pool that, you know, our county's looked at and identified your property is, do you want to participate in something like this? And if you have somebody who's on a fixed income and they're trying to sort of hang on to their own home, this is a great opportunity and a way to match them and give and create spaces that might not have existed but for a little intervention from us trying to marry those people together. So I think we're going to have to get really creative about how we solve the stock issue, because we can't necessarily build units fast enough. Even if you had a perfect land use system, a perfect SDC system, you're just not going to get it done fast enough. This might be a way that if we can get some waivers around a little bit more flexibility with how we do it and how much is paid for, and that those Section 8 waivers are sort of at the max capacity of what somebody would be allowed to use, and extend that into this model, then I think you're going to get people who would be interested in trying this and would come out and have a informational meeting at a county commission office that says, here's how you do this and here's how you participate. And, you know, and we want to make sure that in the bill, you know, we want to make sure that folks have at least a minimum of 6 months, that they are not just in and out, you know, that we want to get connected to folks who this could be a good long-term option for people.
Well, okay, one more question. We've got two other bills to get on to. So
thank
go ahead.
Madam Chair. Just a quick question for the relative or individual that cannot be a relative of the, is that, and it looks like a United States code, is that because this are these are federal dollars? Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm. The Section 8 dollars are federal dollars.
Yeah, and because to me, you know, to eliminate that, there may be a sister that is working, but, you know, really could help her brother, sister, whomever. And but if they had some money to help pay for their expenses, it just seems like a broken model because families trying to help families, if they can't afford to help them, but in a shared situation, they may be able to do more. I just, it's unfortunate. I know that the wording is in there to address federal law, but it's just too bad we can't allow some more opportunity.
Yeah, and Chair Kindergarten, Representative Meek, I'm a little mixed bag on that because, you know, it is also, you also don't want to necessarily get a program caught up in potential for fraud or things like that. And sometimes you see some of those when those kind of family payment type situations. And I would rather have a clean program that nobody puts a lens on and says, well, you know, there's all this fraud happening in that program. I mean, I don't think we have, there are certainly fraud in our federal programs.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it's as rampant as maybe people think it is, but I think having a nice clean process reduces the sort of speculation that, well, we don't need that program because, you know, it's fraud or one, you know. So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. Thank you, Representative Parrish. I think once a Human Services and Housing member, always a member in your heart. So thank you very much for bringing that creative idea forward. So Ryan Fisher is signed up to testify, and Claire from Housing Community Services perhaps can answer any technical question about waivers. Do you know anything about waivers? No. Okay. Ryan.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee. Again, my name is Ryan Fisher, and in addition to representing the community action agencies, I also have the privilege of representing the Oregon Housing Authorities, the statewide association of housing authorities, and that's who I'm here on behalf of today. The housing authorities are the largest provider of affordable housing in the state of Oregon. There are 22 housing authorities that cover all 36 counties, and every year they bring in $175 million of federal funds that go directly to private landlords in communities across the state. We want to thank the carrier for bringing this bill. Obviously, it would apply directly to the housing authorities. And, you know, Claire just mentioned that she does not have specific information about the housing authorities, and that's because the structure is a little bit different with the housing authorities. The funds go from the federal program directly to the local housing authority, so it does not go through Oregon Housing and Community Services on its way to the housing authority. So it formerly called the Section 8 program, now called the Housing Choice Voucher Program, it goes directly to that local housing authority. You know, just on a quick personal note, this bill makes me think of how my dad was able to go to college. He had a large family. They moved from a farm town in Kansas to a college town in Colorado. Because my grandfather wanted them all to be able to go to school. He got a job working at a newspaper, and then they made a room in their basement available to rent out to folks, and that paid their mortgage so that they could make college work. My dad was able to get a basketball scholarship, something that was not in my cards, but it was that renter that was sharing that room that really made the difference in terms of their ability to make their aspirations come true. And so I really like where Representative Parrish is going with this idea. I want to touch a little bit on the fair market rent issue that she talked about the value of the rent assistance that would be able to support this model. And it's actually a broader problem than just with this shared housing model. And just to give sort of a quick explanation of how this works, Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, at the federal level, does surveys for rent levels and then sets what they call the payment standard. And that is what they consider to be the appropriate amount that rent should cost in a community. Then the housing authority has the flexibility to set what they call the fair market rent, which could be up to 110% of that payment standard. So they can go a little bit above. But, you know, as Peggy mentioned earlier, if you're 20 bucks over, in this case with the rent, then you cannot use the voucher to rent that apartment. what we have seen is that the data that HUD uses, that they collect to set these payment standards, is about 3 years old. And so in this current rental market, where things have been moving relatively quickly, quicker than in the past, the fair market rents are not able to keep up with the actual rents that are in the community, and it's making it very difficult for these vouchers to be utilized because they're not competitive. Now, one way that this has been addressed is that Home Forward, which is the housing authority in Multnomah County and a few other places in the region, came together. They had some flexible funds, and they hired a third party, Washington State University, to do a rent study of the area. And then they were able to submit that more current data to HUD in order to get them to raise the payment standard, which they were successful in doing. And then that allowed them to be able to have a more competitive voucher level that they were able to use. And that there's another bill that you will see later this session that kind of goes at that. And I think that would be another way of going at this problem that Representative Parrish has identified. I particularly like, I had a long conversation with Representative Parrish. I particularly like this idea that she has of kind of marketing to folks who are not currently landlords. And I, after meeting with Representative Parrish, sat down with the director of one of the large landlord associations here in the state and talked to them about their ability. You know, one of the things they do is a lot of landlord trainings, fair housing trainings, et cetera. And we talked about ways that they could potentially train these folks who have not previously been landlords in, you know, how to do it the right way. And so that's something that we're going to continue to talk about. And we actually have a history of partnering with landlords. For the past several years, we've done two grants with three groups, the Oregon Housing Authorities, the Multifamily Northwest, which is the Landlord Association, and Oregon Law Center. And the three organizations combined to form the Housing Choice Education Partnership. We got grants from Meyer Memorial Trust, and we've gone around the state doing landlord trainings on changes in law and helping landlords to make sure that they're tracking on some of these changes in law, and then also bringing in community partners like the community action agencies or other community-based organizations and letting them talk to these landlords about the supports that they provide to tenants. And I'll just say, you know, touching on a previous point, there are a lot of other efforts around the state to go out and talk to landlords and recruit them to work with folks coming through community action programs. There was a landlord appreciation breakfast in Medford recently that was very successful, and other types of efforts like that.
So, Ryan, to the question of whether waivers are needed or whether we can already do this through the housing authorities, do you have a determination on that?
So I had talked to one housing authority who indicated that we could do this, but I've since heard that maybe it's only for folks with disabilities that this is possible. Mm-hmm. So I need to continue to dig into this question a little bit further. Okay. If a waiver were required, we've had some past experience with the Housing Authority Association of applying for waivers, and HUD is a little prickly about how they will allow that process to occur. So the waiver that I mentioned earlier, that had to be done for a group, sort of a region that included a county in Washington and other counties in the region. And there are some other similar regions that kind of break up the state of Oregon. In other cases, we were trying to get Multnomah County's Housing Authority Home Forward has a really big and important waiver. It's called Moving to Work, and it gives them broad administrative flexibility and more flexibility in how they can run their voucher program. There are aspects of that that other housing authorities would like to have because they don't have the administrative dollars from HUD that even HUD says you need to be able to run the programs that they're asked to run. And so flexibility in how you do your administration would be helpful in cost efficiency. However, we tried to apply as a state for a waiver, and they said we won't even accept that application. Each housing authority needs to come forward with their own separate application. Mm. So many of them did that, and they were all denied. So there is, you know, And who,
so more work to be done.
More work to be done, yes.
I'm feeling the need to move on from this bill, but it sounds like there are more discussions that you can have about this particular waiver request and possibly even broadening it if there's other flexibilities that you want to seek. And whether we have to, whether we can do that as a state or whether we have to do it county by county housing authority, we'll look into. Okay, so thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2446 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2944 and call up the speaker. Let's introduce this bill. Cassie, could you please read the summary?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2944 requires a hearing for landlords to prove the amount of damages eligible for the Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program prior to judgment against the tenant.
Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Colleagues, good to see you again. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm really glad to hear you're talking about the Housing Choice Section 8 Voucher Program. As you heard, it's the major program for housing affordability here in the state, upwards of a couple hundred million dollars a year from the federal government for these vouchers. It comes with challenges, as this waiver discussion indicated. The bill that we have before you today, House Bill 2944, is an update to something we passed in 2013. In 2013, actually prior to that session, I worked very closely with a group of landlords and advocates to come up with House Bill 2469, which ended up prohibiting discrimination based on source of income, particularly not allowing landlords to discriminate against individuals with vouchers if they were trying to rent. It was a very successful process, really good bill, and it's really helped a lot of Oregonians when it was passed in 13. In the course of passing that bill and in collaboration with the landlords, we created a guarantee fund for landlords to try to allay some fears if folks, when everyone was renting, had to, you know, look at those applications and rent to folks with vouchers if they were having problems. So there is a guarantee fund in the state. What this bill would do is make an update to that bill because it's come to our attention that the structure of how we put that fund together has left it vulnerable to abuse by some landlords. Under the current law, a landlord must obtain a judgment against the tenant in small claims court. However, under the current structure, such judgments can be obtained without any evidence of actual wrongdoing. Currently, if a tenant does not show up in court, the landlord wins by default. Over 80% of cases relating to this fund are default judgments, in part because many low-income tenants just can't get to court. So as it stands right now, a landlord can bring a faulty claim, win on a default judgment, and claim up to $5,000 out of this fund. Meanwhile, that judgment goes on the tenant's record, and also the agency has the authority to send the tenant to collections for the damages. It was not our intent to allow an innocent tenant to get a judgment for a landlord who could be just covering the basic costs of owning a property. And unfortunately, we have some problems. You're going to hear from some folks who will go into more of those details. So what the bill does, and it's super simple and straightforward, and we might have some more amendments, but right now it just says, following a hearing in which the landlord actually proves the amount of damages, then they could have access to the fund. So you're going to hear today about some abuses. It's unfortunate, I think, in general. As you heard, we have a lot of landlords who are working very closely with their housing authorities to be able to be places to rent for folks with vouchers. But this fund was not set up to let folks just come in and basically get wear and tear from these apartments paid for without really having to show due cause. So we'd like to have it updated, and I urge your support if you can get there. Thanks very much.
Okay, any questions for the speaker before? Yes.
Yeah. Two questions. Thank you, yep. Chair Kinnegar. Madam Speaker, I kind of two questions on this. Now that you've blessed me with the ability to be on the Judiciary Committee, it makes me think about these things. One is, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know that anybody up here is, but when you say prove, I know there are different levels of proof. And so I don't know that that's specified in the current language, what that actually means, prove. And then the second question is, would it cause a fiscal with its anticipated increased court time you know, because a court would go real quick if nobody shows up, as opposed to actually going through some sort of a trial or hearing. Just thoughts on it.
So very good questions, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Stark. I don't know. I think you're going to have some people who can ask that question too. I don't know anything about small claims court. And again, the intent, and we had a big back and forth about setting up this fund. And so I'm open to making sure we're not doing, you know, making it, you know, too burdensome on the court, but the goal is to have the landlord to come and explain,
right,
you know, before they can then go to a default judgment, which is most of the time. So, yeah, thank you.
Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. Speaker Kotek, I think that as a landlord and somebody that does property management, when I have to do a turnover, I can get estimates. I can have read the receipts. So I think we can come up with a system that they have to provide either estimates if they couldn't afford to do the work without the funds for those damages, if they're true damages, and or receipts that, you know, had carpets replaced, had these, you know, this refrigerator redone, whatever it was. But so I think proof would have to be more of actual receipts or bids. So.
Thank you, Representative.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I have.
Representative Gorsuch.
Speaker Kotek, these are civil penalties, right? Okay. So in civil court, it's a preponderance of the evidence, 51%. So that would tie in then with what Representative Meek is talking about.
And I think I hope that it would actually lessen the burden on the courts if there were some kind of proof available, then people, to the extent that a few people may be gaming it, would prevent that.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Gorsuch, that would be my assumption. We have a few folks, and you're going to see some numbers of people who know that they can show up and say it cost X and not have to show Y, and so they're coming and tapping into a fund, which right now in our housing crisis should be used only for the right reasons, and so we just need to cut that off.
Yes, thank you.
So I do want to comment on that, because I know that you know, as a social service provider in my other world, that is in fact true. We've been paying upwards of $5,000 and $7,000 of arrears and damages to get people into places to live, and we had one literally recently that was $7,000, and we asked that landlord, show us the receipts, because that is way too much money. Turned out to be only about $3,500. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh well, so this is costing our system money, when those type, and not just on the level of, you know, the fund, it's causing our overall system money to have this be a, you know, an issue for families when they didn't know that they end up with these massive charges. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Okay, thank you, Speaker Kotek.
Thank you.
We have Jill Schirth signed up, and is there anyone else? There's no one else on the list. Yes, and Claire, come on up.
You could just put it in there.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Claire Seguin, and I'm the Assistant Director for Housing Stabilization at OHCS. And so my role here this morning is just to give you a very high-level overview of what the program is all about. So thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and Co-Chair Sanchez and Stark, for having me here this morning to tell you what we do. So mostly Oregon Housing and Community Services is the administrator of the program. And what that means for us is that we process all of the applications, we process all of the repayment plans and the waivers, and we also staff the Housing Choice Advisory Committee, which plays a very important role in this entire program. The committee itself is made up of three different groups of representation. We have three representatives who represent tenant interests. We have three representatives who represent landlord interests. And then we have three representatives from the housing authorities. And together, they are the think tank that works on this program. So in a day, at a quarterly meeting, they might look at our trend reports. They might talk about program design. They might review applications. They talk with staff about challenges that staff is having, and basically give overall guidance about how the program should be run. It's a very effective group with a lot of very dedicated, technically smart people around all of these issues. The other thing that we're responsible for is providing the legislature with an annual report, which the committee is working on as we speak. So you'll see a year-end summary review coming very soon for your review. And I thought that today, I think in your packet, you all have what we call our trends report. The committee looks regularly at a lot of data around this program. We actually have a spreadsheet that has every single application we've received since we started the program so that we can monitor any possible information and shifts and trends that might be important. But we also look at just this general report here, and I think this it should be in your packet. And I just thought I'd highlight a couple of things. On figure 1-1, this shows the counties that have participated. We have 21 counties in the state who participated to date. You'll notice that Marion County has a particularly high spike, and we've had some conversations about that, wondering if it's marketing and outreach, or if it's just landlord awareness, or just familiarity with the program. So we're diving into that conversation much more deeply right now, as a matter of fact. You also have on figure 1.2 the applications that have been received since inception. And you can see clearly that on the left-hand side of the chart, we started off small and we've spiked and we're continuing to sort of level off at about 10 applications a month or so. On the next figure, which is 2.1, you can see our paid claims, and you get a general sense of the type of dollar amounts that we're talking about. You can see that 54% of the claims are just about the maximum amount of $5,000 per claim. So more than half are coming in with the full amount of claim. Figure 2.2 are the judgment expenses, and it breaks out by category the kinds of expenses that we're reimbursing for. And you can see clearly that property damage is the number one reimbursable that we're working on. If we go to 3.1, you can look at the tenant disposition, and this is where you can see sort of where we are with the waiver process and the collections process to give you a sense about how our applications are sort of laying out in that regard. And then finally, figure 3.2 shows you a little bit of a pie chart about the numbers of how many default judgments there are. I think that's the biggest takeaway there, and we've got some folks speaking to that today. And then on the backside, we became interested in whether or not the VASH vouchers were being utilized in this program. And so you can see that, relatively speaking, it's a very small number.
Now
we
have
VASH vouchers are for veterans vouchers. We haven't really gone deeply into why that is such a small number, but I think that's something interesting to note, and we are tracking that. And then the last figure in our trend report is the years in the rental property, and this just gives you a sense about when folks are coming in for these applications, how long their tenants have been there before they need to make the claim. So I think all of these are really good snapshots, really quick, at-a-glance ways that we monitor this program, and the committee is really on top of it, and they're very thoughtful and very appreciative of the time today and of the speaker's interest in the project.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Good morning, Representative Chair Geyer and Vice Chair Stark and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I am Jill Smith. I'm currently serving as the Deputy Director of the Clackamas County Department of Health, Housing, and Human Services for the past 6 months. Prior to this role, I worked for Home Forward as their Chief Operating Officer for 10 years. And I was very involved and served as a member of the Housing Choice Advisory Committee that Claire just had the opportunity to describe, and what our role was, and kind of our ongoing oversight and reporting process that we did. And as she said, it was a very effective and informative committee. We really had the opportunity to dig down and analyze what was going on with this fund. First of all, I want to remind you what Ryan stated a few minutes ago. There's $175 million that comes into our state every year, year after year, for the Housing Choice Voucher Program. It is the biggest rent assistance program for low-income people in the state of Oregon. And that's one of the reasons that this fund was created. It was a mechanism to ensure we can use those dollars. And also keep in mind that failure to use those dollars means you don't get them the next year. So this is a little bit of leverage that really is paying off big time. Um, The home forward has moving to work flexibility, which Ryan also described to you. What it is it's the ability to do things differently, to use traditional money in a different way. And I had the opportunity when I worked there to create a landlord mitigation fund, and it was highly successful, a little bit different than the state one. But it was, as we created the state fund, a lot of the components of that were used. And there's about 9,000 voucher holders that Home Forward oversees, and only about 3% of landlords that were eligible to access that fund did. And that continues to be the trend. With the state fund, only 2% of landlords that are eligible to access the fund have, which is really good news. One of the areas that's a little bit concerning is 10% of all the claims have come from one landlord. So that is a red flag. And I want to tell you a few other red flags that are concerning us. And hopefully you'll see why the request for this change is an easy way to fix this problem. So unfortunately, as the Housing Choice Advisory Committee monitored the utilization of this fund, as I said, we noticed some concerning trends. So Sybil Hebb, Jim Straub, and I, we were all representatives from the three areas, the Housing Authority, the landlord folks, and the tenant advocates. We got together and requested all the files, and we did a thorough review of all the files. This happened last summer because of these concerns. And I just brought a few things that were trends that we noticed. And one example of that of a trend we noticed was there was one voucher holder that had resided in a unit in excess of 10 years. There was a full charge for basically a unit remodel that was taken before a judge. After 10 years, charging somebody for a full carpet update and all new appliances really would never be appropriate. At a minimum, you would be prorating that, you know. But they when they moved in, they weren't new at that time either. So that's just one example of a pattern of abuse that we saw. And because 82% of these folks don't show up at court to speak their side, for good reason, the materials aren't being reviewed. And then the way that this program was set up, no fault at all to the state. Their role is just to take a judgment and make a payment based on that judgment. It was intentionally set up that the fund operates this way because Home Forward was administering this program themselves. Home Forward is large. Other housing authorities around the state really don't have the administrative ability to run another program. They already, unfortunately, don't receive federal funding to do what they're required to. As is. So that's just one example. I wanted to speak really quickly to why people aren't showing up that are voucher holders that are moving, because I know that's a question that we get often. These are folks that are moving for various reasons in a housing crisis. 80% of the people being served by the voucher program are extremely low income. And Ryan talked a little bit about that. And about 65% of them statewide are disabled and elderly people. So that alone kind of explains the issue. They're also in the moving process, hard to find them. Sometimes they don't know what's going on, and they're under a lot of stress. Often these are people who have received a no-cause eviction, or even if they've chosen to move with the vacancy rates the way they are. It's a stressful, tough time for folks. So their ability to mentally be prepared and show up and defend themselves in court is highly unlikely. And when I reviewed the report that Claire created, 17% of the cases brought by landlords for a judgment were contested or mediated with a family being involved, which is just a fraction. So the Housing Choice Advisory Committee overall, even the landlord components, from what I've been told, do agree that there needs to be a change. The landlords really support this fund. This helps them to feel confident as they open up their units and their doors to people who don't have a lot of money in the case of damages. So it gives them, you know, recourse. And of course, the housing authorities and the tenants like it too. We just need a small minor fix to make this work better. And the proposed House Bill 2944 offers a filter that could solve this problem. And I would appreciate your support of it.
Thank you, Jill. And John, you're here in the building a lot, and I know you can come back, so I'm hoping you can just very briefly state where you are on this, because we've got one more bill. Our committee has agreed to stay on till 10, so I really appreciate that, but want to make sure we have time for that one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid, Oregon Law Center. I am the designated lawyer responding to Representative Stark's questions. Representative Meek and Gorsuch were correct. There is no different standard of proof required here. It would be the usual standard of proof of any court matter. Secondly, there may be a fiscal. There are only 170 claims in 3 years, so it's not going to be a big fiscal, but we will meet with the state court administrator and figure that out as we go along.
Okay, quick question.
You have a quick question. From what I understand, a judgment's rendered if the defendant doesn't show up. What's the likelihood of a court actually holding a hearing without a defendant? I mean, I'm not aware of, just being familiar with the court process, I'm not aware of that happening.
Madam Chair, Representative Noble, it's not uncommon for, so I'm happen to be lucky to be married to a woman who sued lots of people for for more money than we're talking about here. And it's not uncommon for those decisions to be entered by default, but to have a court require that the plaintiff prove the damages. So it would be a matter of a short hearing in which the plaintiff shows the documents that Representative Meek referred to, and a judge reviews them and gets a chance to say, well, wait a minute, they've lived there for 10 years. There's got to be some depreciation here. You don't just get to have a new carpet. So there would be a hearing. It would have to be a hearing request. We've talked about how we might do that. We still have to work through the details of how that could be. But it would be the landlord plaintiff asking for a hearing in the default situation.
But there still wouldn't be really any due process.
Well, it would just be the landlord. You're correct. But it would be the landlord with the judge. When I think I take responsibility in hindsight, mistakenly, for suggesting that this would be a good way to screen invalid claims. What we're hearing now is that with the default cases, it may only be a court clerk who looks at that file and just to see whether the steps were met, not whether the damage claim has been, whether there's any proof of it. So we want to get that judge involved for 5 minutes to make the landlord say, here's my proof. Judge to say, okay, fine, you're good. Sign it. That's the goal.
This obviously sounds like something that needs attention. My concern would be those valid claims where no one showed up and then there's no recourse for the whole purpose of having this to be.
Representative Noble, we definitely want to make sure that the valid landlord claims are honored. As Jill mentioned, the goal of the fund is to compensate those landlords who have been wrongly harmed by the requirement that they rent to Section 8 people. We don't want the fund to run out. The landlords don't want the fund to run out. Right. We want to protect the fund and have it be used for valid claims.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2944, open the public hearing on House Bill 2724. I am one of the chief sponsors for this, but I'm going to forego talking about it in the interest of other people commenting. But, Cassie, can you please read the summary? And while we're doing that, can we please have Caitlin, Zoe, and Alexandra come up?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2724 directs Housing and Community Services to develop and implement the Rent Guarantee Program to provide incentives and financial assistance for unpaid rent and for eviction and property damages to landlords renting or leasing to low-income households with certain limitations. The bill requires OHCS to provide tenants from low-income households training on achieving successful tenancy and certification of that training. The bill requires landlords to collect metrics, including length of tenancy, reason for termination, amount of unpaid rent and damages, and provide a report to OHCS before receiving financial assistance. The bill authorizes OHCS to contract with eligible public or private providers to administer the program and distribute funds throughout the state. House Bill 2724 establishes the Rent Guarantee Program fund within the state treasury and appropriates money to OHCS for administration of the Rent Guarantee Program. The bill also defines terms, including landlord, low-income household, and tenant.
Good morning. Thank you for having us, all of you. My name is Caitlin Kennedy. I am with the RentWell Program, and I also oversee the Mitigation Fund in Multnomah County. So just a basic about the RentWell program, it is a 15-hour tenant education course taught in 5 counties currently between 2 different states, both here and Washington. You're receiving a handout right now that will kind of go over the specifics of the program, because I don't want to take up too much of your time. On the back side, it will showcase all the things that we teach each section. At the end of it, an individual receives a certificate along with their completed housing portfolio that they can show landlords. The certificate with Multnomah County goes along with a landlord guarantee fund of up to $2,000. Because we believe in our graduates so much, we say that the program will support up to $2,000 beyond a security deposit if the tenant leaves their residency within 12 months of signing the lease and leaves any damages, past due rent, any legal fees. In the program's history, we have about 7,500 graduates, and of that, 6% of landlords ever even register to attempt to use these funds, and less than 1% ever access these funds. To give you a good example, Clackamas County has about 800 graduates through the whole last 8 years of the program, and they have only ever needed to pay out 2 claims. A claim rate that is very low, and we definitely support our participants. The claims, too, also come in to me as the nonprofit for Multnomah County. So we attempt to avoid the court system altogether. Claims are submitted to me with receipts or estimates. I review them. I will even go see units and do inspections if I need to, and then I will dole out the amount of claims. This year, this fiscal year, we're almost 9 months into it, and there have been no claims even asked for. So it is a fund that is not used that often, and we've had amazing success rates with it. At that point, I want to pass it on over. And if you have any questions for me, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kate.
Soy Copiano. Thank you. I am a housing specialist for Community Action Hillsborough. And our agency is the lead agency for Renwell curriculum in Washington County. We teach the Renwell curriculum over 6 weeks in a series of 2.5-hour class. We have one evening class and one morning class, both at convenient location to accommodate public transportation for our participants. As I personally been an instructor for the last 2 years for the Renwell curriculum, I can attest to the positive impact this class has upon the people we help. The most rewarding part of this class is when a participant who thinks they cannot rent because of a barrier such as prior legal charges on his or her record, credit issues, poor credit, no credit, all evictions, landlord debt, or not having rental history, or poor rental history. This participant discovered through our Renwell class that a second chance is available. That with their willingness to learn, they can have what they desire the most. What we all desire. A place for their children or themselves to go home. During our 6-week series, participants may or are able to be approved for a unit as we provide them with the right tools to assist them in creating a stronger bond between landlords and tenants. We teach them not to be afraid to advocate for themselves in order to assess that human need to call a place home. And more importantly, how to maintain it, because that's kind of like, you know, the big issue of this class is how to maintain it with open and honest communication with the landlord. So we don't have the landlord guarantee fund in Washington County, and that's what I'm here for. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you for having me here, Madam Chair, and
everybody else. My name is Alexandra Appleton, and I am a instructor of instructors of Rentwell. And I'll just real quickly share. I started out as a student, unfortunately, in 2013. I was homeless with my 8-month-old and my 1.5-year-old, and I needed housing. I had good housing history, and I had bad housing history, but I had every single one of the barriers that she just talked about. And so I became a student of the Rentwell program. I was in a shelter, and once I got enough money through employment, then I moved into my own apartment, and I've been in that stable place since then. It's been over 3 years, but it was really me finding that apartment that made me realize that this actually works. And so then that's when I became trained to instruct classes, and I taught the classes at Mercy Corps Reentry Transition Center, and specifically they deal with people with criminal histories. So you can imagine they have like huge barriers. They come out and they're like, how am I going to find housing? They have to find housing. It's part of their probation. So among all other types of things. But I've taught that for 2 years, and then I became the instructor. But what I can say is that the program is very empowering. The students come in and there's no way I'm gonna find housing. I have this, I have this, I have this, I have this. But I have seen people within 2 weeks, the little bells start going off, you know? And I've seen people find housing before they graduate. I've seen disabled families living in cars find housing. I've seen people with criminal histories of 10 years and find housing. I mean, I've seen people find housing and stay in housing. That's the thing. The program not only teaches you how to find housing, but it helps you maintain the housing. And another thing I want to say is that the students find that they are so resourceful, and that's what we forget. Like, people that have barriers that in these type of situations, that the homeless surviving on the streets, like they feel like they're stigmatized, that they're stigmatized, and they don't have the skills to survive. But really, what this class does is empowers the students to realize, wow, I can not only get into housing, but I can maintain it despite me losing my job again, despite the kids getting sick again, despite all these bad things that can happen. And then with the landlords, my personal landlord has even asked me. With 3 rent increases, I might say, my landlord has asked me, you know, where's the program? How can we send more students through the program? And I just want to say that it's been a joy to see people find housing. People have stopped me on the street and said, if it wasn't for you, if it wasn't for your class, I don't know where I would be right now. And so I can't say anything bad about the program. It's been awesome. And thank you for letting me be here.
That's fantastic. We have about 2 minutes. Any questions, Representative?
No questions. Hurd? Just thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, ladies, for coming and testifying. It sounds like a great program, and I'd like to thank the Chair for this bill.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we're running out of time, even though you agreed to stay till 10. Thank you so much for coming. Ryan Fisher is the one that brought this here and had signed up, but he wanted to give you his time, but he is in the building, so ask if you have any questions. My understanding is that this used to be run through the state, and then when the funds dried up, some of the counties have continued it. Some only do the, and I believe that Vice Chair Sanchez has run this program as well, or overseen the
we
program.
We still have it, yes.
So some counties give money and continue to do the Rentwell training, the curriculum, but some may not, as in Washington County, may not have the mitigation fund. This is an example of where we're really trying to help both sides. We're trying to help tenants overcome barriers and take some responsibility for becoming good tenants, and in return for landlords taking somewhat of a risk on people who may have a bad credit history, may have been incarcerated. We give them both the assurance of the certificate of Rentwell, but also the mitigation fund of 2%, which you can see, because the training is so good, has only been used 1% of the time for those that even ask for this certificate. So I think it's a great program, and really appreciate everyone's staying and listening. And so with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2724 and close our House Committee on Human Services and Housing. House Bill 2724 and close our House Committee.